Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is astronomer and science communicator, Dr. Phil Plate. Phil, welcome.
Hi, John. Thanks for having me on.
Hey, I'm so excited about having you on the show. It's great to have you. I've been wanting to do this for quite a while. And having an astronomy background myself, it's always fun to geek out with astronomers. So welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Your bio starts off with your PhD in astronomy from the University of Virginia, but I want to know about before that. When did you realize you first wanted to become an astronomer?
Oh, ever since I was a little kid. A lot of astronauts and astronomers have pretty much the same story.
It's
really quite amazing if you ask them. Somebody, their parents, a friend, a neighbor, or they went to a star party, but somebody put them in front of a telescope. And typically, they either saw the moon or Saturn.
Saturn.
For me, it was Saturn.
Me too.
Yeah. My parents bought a really terrible department store telescope, which I loved and maintained lovingly for many years. But we set it up in the driveway, and I looked at Saturn. And you can see the rings even through a little tiny telescope. Mm-hmm. And I was stunned. And I remember right there thinking I wanted to be, well, probably an astronaut. I really wanted to be an astronaut then. But that was during the Apollo era. And between that and dinosaurs, I knew I was going to be in science. But eventually that turned into astronomy.
Did you major in astronomy as an undergraduate?
Yeah, I went to the University of Michigan and was an astronomy major there. Then got into grad school at UVA, got my master's and PhD, and then went on into a career of communicating astronomy.
Tell me about your PhD thesis. I'm curious.
That's a long story, but
okay.
the synopsis, the short version, is I wound up working on signing up for a project to use Hubble Space Telescope shortly before it launched. And by shortly, I mean like 2 weeks. I signed on to this project, and I want to say early April or late March in 1990. Hubble launched a few weeks later, and our project was to study exploding stars, supernovae. And we had some data coming in right away. The object we were studying, which is called Supernova 1987A, which recently had its 30th anniversary. It was discovered on February 23rd, 1987. Those observations were made public, and we got them right away. And right away, I saw that the telescope wasn't focusing correctly. And that was a problem. I basically spent the next 2 years working on how to make the data look better. Eventually, we got more data, and I was able to study the environment around this exploding star. Basically, for me, you know, a lot of people study stars because they're cool when they blow up. For me, it was a light bulb. It went off and lit up all the gas that was around the star, and that's mm-hmm. what I wound up studying is the behavior of that bizarre structure around it that's shaped kind of like an hourglass.
Cool. I think we've all seen photos of that. Yeah.
It's a pretty famous Hubble shot.
Yeah.
These three rings that are sort of one centered right on the exploding star and two on either side. And it's a really bizarre object. And since then, we've found more of them. We think it has to do with the star. Well, we know it has to do with the star's behavior before it explodes. But how exactly it forms this weird hourglass figure eight shape isn't really clearly understood just yet, even after all these years. So it's pretty cool that we're still studying that thing, even after oh my gosh, been 30 years now.
We discovered it in 1987. That's when the light reached us. But when did it explode?
Well, it's 160,000 light years away, something like that. It's in a nearby galaxy, a satellite galaxy, the Milky Way, called the Large Magellanic Cloud. I was writing about the Small Magellanic Cloud this morning. It's on my brain. The Large Magellanic Cloud, and it's about 160,000 light years away.
So the
star,
light left.
You want to think of it that way, blew up then, and the light took that reaches.
Wow. Pretty cool. So you are still an amateur astronomer, I read. What kind of telescopes do you have? That's always a fun topic.
Well, my first telescope was a little dinky 3-inch refractor by Tasco, and anybody who had one will recognize that name. Not a high quality instrument. I saved up my money when I was a teenager and bought a 10-inch Newtonian, which was a monstrous telescope at the time. It was like a water heater. Wound up selling that, got a 12.5-inch reflector, but it was even though a bigger mirror, it was a lighter weight telescope and easier to use, which was nice. Gave that one away, and now I am the proud owner of a Celestron 8-inch Schmidt-Cassegrain, which, you know, if you look up your basic telescope, that's what it kind of, you know, it's what kind of pops up.
I have one of those, too.
Yeah,
yeah, it's kind of nice. Like the telescope that amateurs have, the 8-inch Schmidt-Cassegrain. I think that's the most widely used amateur telescope there is.
I wouldn't be surprised. It's, you know, if 6 inches is kind of small to see faint objects, and if you get bigger than 8 inches, it starts getting unwieldy. And so an 8-inch is just the right size to, like, yeah, you know, oh, Jupiter's up, I'm going to haul my tripod out and stick the scope on it and take a look.
What kind of skies do you have up there in Boulder? Is it pretty good seeing?
Well, it's kind of funny. When I lived closer to Boulder, it was really nice. I had dark skies. I could see a lot of things. I moved out into the country a few years ago, but in fact, there are just town lights all around me. And so even though I'm actually farther out in the country, my skies are actually worse than they used to be. But still, you know, meteor showers and various things, I go out and I can see things, mm-hmm. and it's a lot of fun. Still do it all the time.
I have an astronomer friend who lives in Tucson. He's got 7.5 magnitude naked eye skies in Tucson.
Oh, well, you've got good eyes. Yeah, that's really dark, but that's a dark sky town. That's literally, they have
laws.
That's
why Kitt Peak is there,
Yeah. Out here, not so much. So it's nice, and, you know, it's beautiful. I have the mountains and everything, and the weather here is usually pretty nice. But for observing, you know, there's a reason you've never heard of any really famous observatories in Colorado.
Right, right. They're all in New Mexico and Arizona and Hawaii.
Yeah.
So when you were a PhD student, you were also teaching astronomy, right? Labs at nights and also at the public observatory.
Right. I was a TA, teacher's assistant, and a research assistant, and you have to, you know, be there for some lectures when the professor is teaching and grade the tests and do all that. But we also ran labs, and so I was happy to run the telescope lab for one of the classes, and that was fun. You'd go out almost every night and help the students with the telescopes, and they have to observe a few things and draw what they're observing. And hear them complain, I can't find that globular cluster. And then I would find it in like 5 seconds, show it to them through the eyepiece, and then move the telescope. And they'd get really angry at me. It's like, you jerk. And it's like, well, no, I'm just showing you can find it. But you got to remember, I've been doing this for 15 years. You know, it's my love and my hobby. So it's easy. But, you know, I wasn't trying to be too much of a jerk. I'd show them how, you know, the tricks. You find a bright star and you move off to another bright star and that sort of thing. And you got to realize, too, this was long before computers were attached to telescopes like you get now. And if you wanted to find something,
setting circles.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's all. You could either use setting circles or you could just use the finder and find, you know, there's Vega, a bright star, and move it to this bright star next to it, and then there's your object. And it just takes some finesse and practice. But I found that by the end of the semester, a lot of the students really, really enjoyed the time they spent under the stars.
Is that where you got kind of turned on, like igniting other people's minds about the sky?
I hadn't thought of it that way. But yeah, sure. Actually being there with people who may not know this stuff, but are at least interested in it, because the telescope lab was an optional lab that you would take. So, you know, some of them had to do it for various reasons, but most of them were doing it because they wanted to take the class. And that was a lot of fun. I wound up teaching at a couple of local community colleges. And at that point, the World Wide Web was brand spanking new. And I started writing about astronomy as well. And that was the beginning of the career I have now.
So did that career start with you working with the COBE satellite? Or was it the Hubble at Goddard? Which was first?
Well, let's see. I got my PhD using Hubble, and then I got a job right out of that using COBE, which is the Cosmic Background Explorer. And this was a satellite that was observing in microwaves, so wavelengths far outside what the eye can see. But the universe glows in this radiation, and that's left over from the Big Bang. It's basically the heat of the Big Bang fireball that has cooled over almost 14 billion years and redshifted out to microwave wavelengths. And by studying that, you can actually figure out a lot about the structure of the universe and how it was born. That's what this satellite was doing. But at the time when I was hired, basically the satellite was done. We had all the data. And, you know, people were already moving on. So I just kind of came in and cleaned up a little bit. And the problem with that was all the leftover problems that we still had, anything that was left to be done, were problems that were too hard to have been solved. All the easy stuff was done years before I was hired. So really, I was given an almost impossible task of you know, here's a fresh out of college PhD student, and here, fix all these problems that we've already spent several thousand man hours, you know, not being able to fix. So in the end, I basically wound up looking for another job almost right away. The project was winding down. And I got hired to work on Hubble again on a new camera called STIS.
Thanks to your PhD thesis, right?
Yeah, basically. And I used the particular kind of software I used for my PhD was the kind this group was using. So they hired me. And I got to spend several more years working on Hubble. It was great.
Cool, cool. And you were working on the imaging spectrograph.
That's right. It was a camera that was being built and was going to launch onto Hubble in 97. So that was really cool to go from a satellite that was basically fairly old technology to something that was cutting edge and, you know, not even built yet. So I was hired to help characterize it. It's like, you know, light goes in one end. What do you expect to see out the other? And that's what I did. But when we launched and it worked, and oh my gosh, did it work great. We were observing galaxies, black holes, stars exploding, stars forming. And I got to work on a lot of these science topics to help work on their data, basically get the data ready for the scientist who was in charge of the specific project so that they could analyze it. And it was so much fun to see all these amazing images and think, you know, nobody else has seen this before in this clarity. And, you know, here I am just looking at it on my computer screen. It was amazing.
Excellent. So by and by, though, you came to the idea of science outreach and science education. What triggered that transition?
Well, I'd always enjoyed going out, and I've always enjoyed talking about astronomy. But there actually was an event. I went to a local nature center when I lived in Maryland, working at Goddard Space Flight Center. And it was a place I enjoyed going to. It wasn't too far from my house. And I asked them if there was anything I could do to help them do any astronomy stuff. Turns out they were doing an event to line up with the Leonid meteor shower, which happens in November every year. But they didn't really know what they were doing. I mean, they were enthusiastic and they were, you know, they had done their research and everything, but none of them was an amateur astronomer. And they were like, you know, if you know your way around the sky, please. So I volunteered to help them. I wound up talking about it with somebody I worked with, Steve Marin, who was also at Goddard at the time. And it turns out he is the liaison between professional astronomers and the media. So if you're you know, CNN or whatever, and you need an astronomer to talk, you'd wind up talking to Steve.
Uh-huh.
Well, he came along to this outing, saw that I enjoyed doing this, and that I had, I guess, you know, I had some talent at it. And so he wound up afterwards sending a lot of places like CNN, MSNBC my way when they needed interviews. And at that point, it was like, yeah, I love doing this. I'm having so much fun. And I knew I wanted to
cool.
do this as a career.
Is that what brought you to Sonoma State University?
Yeah. After a while, you know, the funding on STIS started winding down, and I started looking for another job. And at Sonoma State, Lynn Kaminsky, who was an astrophysicist, was doing a lot of public outreach with NASA grants for high-energy satellites. So we're talking things that look at X-rays and gamma rays. And with STIS, I was doing a little bit of high energy work with ultraviolet stuff. So I thought, why not? And I applied, and she hired me, and I was out there for 6 or 7 years, 7, 8 years, writing about all of these satellites, and the work they were doing, including, stuff for students in classrooms, because the electromagnetic spectrum is part of the national standards, things like that. And it was fun. We wrote pamphlets. We wrote games, websites, anything you can do to teach science.
Awesome.
And it was pretty cool.
I was watching Star Talk with Neil deGrasse Tyson, and somebody asked him, what would the sky look like if you could see beyond the visible, if you could see into the infrared and microwaves and into the ultraviolet? What would the sky look like? Has anybody ever done a planetarium program where you flip a switch and here's what the sky looks like across all the wavelengths?
In fact, yes. I've seen some planetarium shows like that. There's also a website, and oh my gosh, I can't remember the name. I believe it's called Chromoscope, and I don't want to look it up here off the top of my head because then you'll hear my keys clacking and all that, but you can maybe put that in the show notes.
Sure.
And you can literally, you know, look at an object or the sky and then click on a different wavelength and see what the sky looks like in the ultraviolet, the infrared, microwaves, x-rays, and all that. It's really cool.
That would be cool. So far we've done a cool, interesting story about your background. It's time for a break. When we come back, I want to ask you about bad astronomy and all sorts of other technical good stuff. But first, a word from Kelly. Folks, we'll be back in 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage, where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thanks, Kelly. I'm chatting with Dr. Phil Plait, astronomer. I remember when I first heard of you. It was this discussion of the fallacies of the moon landing hoax. And I remember reading about how you were bursting the balloon of these people who were claiming that it was just a giant hangar with black felt and it was all faked and it couldn't possibly happen. And I remember one of your arguments that stuck in my mind for like years and years and years was the idea that, well, all these Apollo astronauts took a lot of photos on the moon's surface and none of them show any stars. So that's proof that it must have been faked because a real Hasselblad camera would have shown the stars in the sky. So let's talk about that and some of the other stuff that you did. Why don't we see stars in those photos?
Yeah, this is it's a ridiculous claim to fame to basically be debunking people who believe in ridiculous things like faking the moon landings.
We need to do that, though.
And it's funny because they make hundreds of claims, but there are a few basic ones that you see over and over again. And those are the ones I actually wrote about and talked about. And yeah, no stars in the pictures is one of the biggest ones. And when you look at the Apollo pictures, you see the moon and you see the astronauts and you might see the lunar lander there, but the sky is black.
Mm-hmm.
And they would make all kinds of confusing claims about this. And the sky is black even when the sun is up on the moon because there's no air. The sky is blue here on Earth because we have air, and the reason it turns blue is a different thing. But the fact is the atmosphere gets very bright, much brighter than the stars, and so you don't see stars during the day. And once the sun sets, it's not lighting up the atmosphere, and you can see the stars. Well, on the moon, the sky is black because there's no air, even when the sun is up.
Right.
But the question then becomes, why don't you see the stars in the pictures? And the answer is, we didn't go to the moon to take pictures of the stars. We went to the moon to take pictures of the moon. And so when these guys took their pictures, the astronauts took the photographs, they set the camera aperture and shutter speed to correctly balance the picture for them. Now, they're standing in full sunlight. They're wearing, you know, a bright white spacesuit, or they're looking at the moon itself, which is sort of a dull gray. But basically, even when you do that, you're taking a photo that is at something like a hundredth of a second with a small aperture. And that makes the moon come out right in the exposure, but it's not nearly long enough to take pictures of the stars. You just don't see them.
And you can try that yourself with your camera. You know, if you have a camera, you can go out at night, point it at the sky, take a photo at 1/100th of a second and see what you get. You'll get nothing.
Yeah, you won't get much. And in fact, the flip side of this is that on Apollo 16, they did bring an ultraviolet telescope with them because that kind of ultraviolet light doesn't get through our atmosphere. So on the moon, they could take ultraviolet pictures of the sky, which you can't do from the ground. And those images are available, and you can see stars in them. Some of the brighter, hot stars emit ultraviolet light bright enough that you can see them in the Apollo pictures. So everything about this claim is ridiculous.
What were some of the other false claims that are notable that needed to be debunked?
Well, one of them that's really funny is the shadows aren't parallel in the pictures. And you can see this in some of them. The shadow cast by an astronaut in the foreground doesn't seem to be parallel with the shadow cast by the lunar lander, which might be in the background. And they claim that that's because there were multiple light sources being used on the set. And my argument right away is, you know, if they used multiple light sources, you'd see multiple shadows. So you don't see multiple shadows from every object. So clearly that's not right. And in fact, the shadows are parallel, but you're seeing a perspective effect. It's the same sort of thing you see if you're standing on railroad tracks and they seem to converge on the horizon. That's perspective. It's the vanishing point. And it's the exact same thing on the moon. You can go out into a parking lot at a shopping center and look at all of the parallel lines in the parking lot, and they won't look parallel. They'll look like they're pointing in different directions simply because of perspective. And the funny thing is, a lot of these moon hoax folks claim that they're professional photographers, and yet they don't know the most basic stuff about photography. And it makes me wonder, you know, if you don't even know this, why should I believe you about any complicated science stuff you're trying to claim?
Okay, we have time for one more.
Okay.
You want to talk about waving flags, or you want to talk about something else?
Waving flags is a good one, too. They show video of the astronauts putting the flag into the moon surface, and you can see the flag flapping. And they're saying, hey, if there's no air, why is the flag flapping? And it's like, and one guy even claims, maybe there was a gust of air from the air conditioning on the set. And it's like, really? And the director didn't yell, cut? I have filmed stuff, you know, for TV and that sort of thing. It doesn't matter how small of an error it is. The director's going to yell cut and do it again. They would notice a flag flapping. And it turns out you don't need air for that. The flag was made of nylon. It's hanging from a rod. And as you move the rod back and forth, the flag is just going to move through inertia. It has nothing to do with air.
It's just natural texture of the flag plus gravity.
Yeah. And if you look at the video and you really think about it, the flag is flapping too much. And that's because there's no air and there's lighter gravity on the moon. And so the corner of the flag is flipping way up, much higher than it would on the Earth, because there's no air. And that's another typical thing for this claim. And, you know, it's not just moon hoax. It's almost every sort of anti-science claim is that when you look at the evidence carefully, it actually shows that what they're claiming is wrong right there in front of your face if you understand the evidence.
Interesting. And then you wrote a book. And that's how you became the bad astronomer, right? Writing all these articles about debunking the idea of a hoax. And so that's really put you on the map with me, and that's where I first learned about you.
Oh, I'm glad you saw that. Yeah, Bad Astronomy was my first book, basically debunking a lot of this stuff. And then I wrote a second book called Death from the Skies, which was about all the ways the universe can try to kill us.
I want to get to
asteroid
that in a second.
Asteroid impacts, solar flares, that sort of
yeah,
thing.
Yeah, I want to get to that in a minute. But,
okay.
But first, aside from the moon landing stuff, what are some of the other modern-day science myths or misrepresentations that keep cropping up and that you have to keep debunking, aside from the moon landing? Anything else come to mind about what you have to keep explaining over and over again to people?
Is this a six-hour podcast?
Let's just pick a couple.
Yeah, the two big ones right now, and have been for many years, are people who think global warming is a hoax. And another big one is people who think vaccines are not safe, mm-hmm. give you autism or are some nefarious government plan for mind control. Both of these are wrong. Global warming is real. We know this is real. The basic physics behind it has been known for 100 years. We are dumping 30 to 40 billion tons of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere every year.
Not pounds, billion tons.
Billions of tons every year. Way more than anything else. No volcano has ever put out that much. And so we are dwarfing all natural sources of carbon dioxide. It stays in the atmosphere for centuries. And it basically does not let infrared light out. So the sun warms the planet with visible light. The planet responds by emitting infrared light, but with that extra CO2, a little bit of it is sticking around in the atmosphere and heating it up.
The greenhouse effect.
And we see this, and all the evidence points towards this. The oceans are getting warmer. They're expanding. Sea level rise is going up. They're acidifying due to the extra CO2. We directly measure the CO2. I mean, I could go on
killing
and on
plankton.
And on.
Yeah.
And the thing is here is that this is no longer a scientific question. It's a political one because there's a political bias to try to downplay this.
Right.
Much
right.
like there
gets
was
in the
a
way
corporate
of business.
Bias.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Gets in the way of business. Keeps people from, you know, building coal factories, coal power plants, and keeps people from getting wealthy, building energy sources, and it just those darn
or
scientists
from, they from keep, those companies they keep, when you're a politician.
They keep getting in our way, those darn scientists. They keep us from plundering the planet.
And it's a problem because the science is quite clear, but politically it's being muddied on purpose. And we know this. I mean, we know that there are fossil fuel companies who have basically funded disinformation campaigns, and they're based on the same sort of techniques that the tobacco companies used. And we know this because the same people are involved spreading the same kind of misinformation on purpose to muddy the waters. And it's a problem.
One more element on that. I hear people saying that because there was a snowstorm in my area, that means that there is no global warming everywhere.
Right.
Give us some insight on that.
Well, yeah, this is a very common claim. It's a lot of politicians make the same claim. Gee, it's snowing today. Wish there were more global warming. And it's like, well, global warming doesn't mean the whole planet is now on fire. It just means that the average temperature is going up. It still gets cold enough every winter. We still have seasons. It still snows. And in fact, with global warming, at least for a little while, we expect to see more snow because, paradoxically, a warmer atmosphere can hold more moisture. You get more evaporation off of lakes, more evaporation off of oceans.
Mm-hmm.
There's more snow for when it gets cold.
All that water from the Antarctic and the Arctic.
Yes, and from the Arctic, from the sea ice melting.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, the way we like to characterize it is that weather is your mood, but climate is your personality. So you need to, you know, your mood is just hour to hour, day to day. That's weather, changes all the time. But climate changes much more slowly, and that's your personality, whether you're prone to be happy or sad or angry. And so that's what you have to keep in mind. Don't confuse the two. Weather turns into climate after 20 years, 30 years. But for right now, we know that the climate is changing because the globe is warming. That is a fact.
That global warming plus the possibility of an unexpected extinction event from a comet has people thinking about today, about the convergence of our technology and our ability to travel in space, Elon Musk, SpaceX, and the technology of robots and androids that would assist us, and propulsion technology all seem to have us moving towards the idea of colonizing Mars to make sure that if something happened to the Earth, the species would survive. And I saw this Nat Geo 6-part series recently. It was really cool. It was part documentary and part drama about the colonization of Mars. Do you think we're ready for that? Is this something full speed ahead? Are you on board with that?
That's a complicated situation. I am all for colonizing Mars eventually. It's a big step. I would rather see us putting a base on the moon, which is close by. It's only 3 days away by rocket, or possibly less if we have more powerful rockets. And that would teach us a lot about what it's like to have to live in a low gravity environment, what it's like to live so isolated from Earth. Getting to Mars is not just planning.
Days.
It's a 6-month trip.
Yeah.
And so it's not just a longer trip. You need to bring a lot more supplies. You need to have much better recycling. And radiation is more of a problem on that trip.
Is there something special about Mars that makes it more attractive?
Well, it's a planet, right?
The moon's not really an atmosphere, and it has maybe water, and the gravity is a little higher than the moon, like 35% instead of 1/6. Is that what makes it so attractive?
It's different. There are things that would make it easier than living on the moon because the gravity is twice as high as the moon. It's a third of the Earth's gravity versus a sixth. And you have a little bit of an atmosphere, not much.
1%.
The thing is, you get dust storms. You don't get dust storms on the moon. You would on Mars. An advantage is it has a roughly 24-hour day. It's just a little bit longer than our day. Whereas on the moon, it's 2 weeks long to from sunrise to sunset.
But the environmental challenges are the same. You still have to wear spacesuits. You still have to build chambers and living facilities that can withstand 1% atmosphere difference instead of 0%. So the construction and the expense of providing living quarters seems to be about the same as on the moon.
Roughly, yeah. The composition of Mars is different than the moon, but you can probably mine the surface, you know, the soil. It's not really soil; it's just ground up rocks.
Regolith.
It's all over the surface. It's called regolith.
Yeah.
And you can do that on the moon and Mars and find what you need to build things, building materials. There's water, hydrogen. You can make fuel and oxygen out of this to breathe. A lot of those challenges are the same. We probably either wind up building domes and covering them with rock to protect them from radiation, or building underground.
Right.
But there are, you know, there are challenges to both, and we don't know how to do this exactly yet. And that's why I prefer the moon. It's close by. If there's a problem, you can get stuff there more rapidly, or get your people out of
help. Yeah. Yeah. No, otherwise, you face scenarios where, like The Martian, the movie, where you can be stranded for a long time. It's a very lonely place.
Yeah, it's hard to get to Mars for a lot of, you know, it could be on the other side of the sun, and then you're really screwed. The moon is 3 days away pretty much no matter what. So if there's a problem, you can get back to Earth that much more rapidly.
I want to get back to the book that you wrote, the second book, Death from the Skies. Tell us about what that's all about.
Well, that was a lot of fun. I've always been interested in asteroid impacts on the Earth as well as exploding stars. And these are both, you know, fairly epic catastrophes. And the idea of writing about everything I could think of that could affect the Earth astronomically, at least coming from the sky, seemed like a kind of a fun thing, although maybe a bit grim. So I wound up writing this book about asteroid impacts, solar flares, you know, what happens if a black hole passes near the Earth. And the fun thing about the book is that as terrifying as all the topics are, either they're extremely rare. I mean, a black hole is never going to get close enough to the Earth to affect anything that's happening to us. Or they're more common, like asteroid impacts and solar storms, but there are things we can do about them. We can prevent asteroid impacts, and we can prevent big solar flares from affecting our power grid if we choose to do so.
Did you rank those items according to the probability? Because I'm curious about whether death by nearby supernova is more likely than death by comet out of the blue from the Oort cloud.
Oh, well, absolutely. By any standard, death by asteroid or comet impact is the biggest problem right now. Even that, it's fairly low odds. I mean, in the end, as I keep telling people who worry about this kind of stuff, we're here. We've been here. Humans have been around for millions of years, or about a million years, depending on how you count it. And life on Earth has been around for about 4 billion years. So nothing has completely wiped us out. So these things are still pretty rare. And a nearby supernova is only likely to happen once or twice since the Earth itself was formed. So it's not like close enough at least to affect us. And we have not since the Earth was formed, but every few million years, something like that. I'd have to look it up. I don't have my book in front of me. We do, in fact, have evidence for a nearby exploding star about 3 million years ago. It does seem to happen every now and again. But even then, it's like 3 million years ago, and we're here. It didn't really seem to affect life on Earth. So these things aren't as big of a risk as you might think.
So that the Earth's magnetic field does a lot for us, protecting us.
And our atmosphere.
Boy, yeah. Yeah. Those two together really have helped out.
Yeah, we're protected from a lot of this stuff by just the fact that the Earth has a magnetic field. We have a thick atmosphere. It absorbs a lot of the radiation. It absorbs a lot of the smaller rocks that come in and burn up in our atmosphere. And, right. It's a concern, as I point out. Big solar storms are a concern. Asteroid impacts are a concern. But I don't, lie awake at night staring at the ceiling panicked about them. We can prevent them.
Should we be doing more? Should we be investing more money in near Earth or asteroid observations?
Absolutely. We have big telescopes coming online right now, that's important for finding them and characterizing them and seeing if there's any out there that has our name on it. But we don't have the technology right now to do anything about it. Or at least I should say we have the technology, but we haven't tested it. We need to build a space probe that can impact an asteroid and sort of push it out of our way and see if that's what we want to do. Or do we want to tug it out of the way? Do we want to paint it white and let sunlight heat one side versus the other? And that can actually exert a force on the asteroid and change its orbit over time. We need to test all these things out, make sure they work, because we don't want to have, 2 years before an impact with some rock headed our way, and then have to start figuring this out. We want to already know what to do when that happens.
Right. Speaking of knowing what to do, I want to spend the few minutes left on extraterrestrial life. And there's several different things I want to ask you about. Recently, there was an exciting announcement from NASA about a star virtually in our backyard, only 39 light years away, which is pretty darn close, called TRAPPIST-1. And we found, NASA found, seven planets not a whole lot different than Earth, kind of small and rocky instead of giant and gaseous. Tell us about this discovery.
Yeah, this is really cool. TRAPPIST-1 is a really tiny red dwarf. It's a star that is very low mass. It has about a 12th of the mass of the sun, which means it's not very hot and it's very feeble, the amount of light it gives off. It's not even visible to the naked eye, even though it's 40 light years away, which is relatively close. For a long time, we didn't even know if stars like this could have planets. And eventually, we started finding planets around red dwarfs like TRAPPIST-1. Last year, three discovered, and all three the size of the Earth, and could even have roughly the same temperature, which is exciting. But there was a little bit in the data that indicated there might be more planets. And so more telescopes were used. And sure enough, they found four more for a total of seven. And all of these planets orbit very close to the star, much closer than Mercury even orbits the sun. But the thing is, the star is so feeble that some of these planets are basically getting the same amount of heat that we do here on Earth. Three of these planets actually may have temperatures similar to ours. We don't know. The method that was used to find them really only tells us how far they are from the star, how long it takes them to orbit, and how big the planets are. And bizarrely, all seven of them are roughly the size of the Earth. Some are a little bit smaller, some are a little bit bigger, but all seven of them are probably small rocky planets like ours.
And could have water, possibly.
Possible. Three of them may have temperate conditions on the surface, but the thing is, we don't know. They may have an atmosphere, they may not. They may be very hot, they may be very cold. I mean, look at Venus, Earth, and Mars. All three of these planets are technically in the sun's habitable zone, in a region where you could have liquid water on the surface. But Venus has a very thick atmosphere, and the surface is hot enough to melt lead.
Right.
And Mars has a very thin atmosphere.
Runaway greenhouse.
And it's freezing there.
Yeah.
So, you know, it really depends on the local conditions. Even the Earth would be a frozen solid if it didn't have an atmosphere. Where we are from the sun, the average temperature should be below freezing. But our atmosphere, because of the greenhouse effect, warms us, and we can have liquid water. So all of this is very dependent. We don't know any of this stuff about these planets. So who knows what they're really like? But what that means is we should be studying them more and find out more. That's the exciting part.
So in addition to the seven planets around TRAPPIST-1, to date we've discovered over 3,000 planets in orbit around stars. So in my mind, it kind of looks like a trade-off there. We've come to the conclusion that probably most stars have planets, which is good for the prospect of extraterrestrial life, because there's this famous equation called Drake's equation that estimates the probability of an intelligent communicative race that we might be able to talk to. And one of the factors in that equation is, what's the probability this star will have planets? Well, now we know it's pretty good, but the diversity and the starkness of these planets we've discovered so far doesn't really look like, you know, because there's many of them are so big and so gaseous or so small and hot, that so far it doesn't seem to me like the prospects of intelligent life anywhere on these 3,000 planets we discovered and more so far is very good. So is that kind of a trade-off in Drake's equation where, you know, life is very, very unique, even though planets are very, very common? What do you think?
Yeah, it's a you know, good news, bad news situation. The good news is, we think that planets outnumber stars in the galaxy. There are probably hundreds of billions of planets in the galaxy. That's the good news. The bad news is most of them are pretty awful places. They're like gas giants that are super hot, orbiting close to their star. Or they're like Neptune. They're too massive and have a thick atmosphere. And ones like Earth, the same size, or maybe with rock and metal, are too hot, too cold. But you know what? I still think that's good news because, first of all, we didn't know about any planets orbiting other stars until 1992 and planets orbiting stars like the sun in 1995. And after that discovery, we started finding more and more. And now we know there are so many of them, we couldn't even count them all. And that means that even though a planet like the Earth, where there's a lot of stuff on the Earth to make it habitable, we have this atmosphere. It has a certain composition, a certain temperature, a chemical composition to the rocks and the crust and tectonics and all of these things, the magnetic field that protect us. You have all of these special things, but it turns out, yeah, sure, even if only one in a million planets is like the Earth, that means there are hundreds of thousands of them in the galaxy. So even in the thousands that we found a couple that look like they might be like ours. And as we get better at this, I know we'll find more. But even then, you know, who knows if they have life on them? Life seemed to arise on Earth pretty easily once the surface of our planet cooled enough for liquid water to exist. That we know life's been around for 4 billion years or roughly. So that's a long time. It seems that life can form relatively easily. If that's the case, you know, where are they? That's the basic question.
Yeah, it's the Fermi
paradox.
Maybe
interstellar travels too hard, right? Or, you know, who knows?
Fermi paradox, where are they?
Yeah, if you have a civilization that's a million years older than the Earth, they should have been able to colonize basically the entire galaxy by now.
Right.
Where are they?
Right. Where are
Don't
they?
Know. You know, but that's the beauty of that question is that we couldn't hope to answer that question 30 years ago. But now we're circling in on it. The more data we have, the more we're able to understand how life arose. While some of this might be, you know, disconcerting or disheartening, all of it is information. And it's information we need. So for me, that's all good news.
Cool. Well, you've given us a lot to think about. Guess what? We're out of time.
Ah.
So I just have one more question for you. So
sure.
There are so many websites, so many books and podcasts and classes. If somebody were interested or somebody were inspired by this conversation and they wanted to learn more, what would be a few of the very best resources for people to learn about the Earth and its place in the universe and astronomy?
Well, if I can be self-serving, which is so unlike me, I put together with Hank Green from Vlogbrothers. He sponsors a series of educational YouTube videos called Crash Course. And I hosted and wrote Crash Course Astronomy, which is a 46-part web series, 10 minutes each. So you can, it's very bite-sized, going over the basic issues of almost everything I could think of in astronomy. It's like a college course. Very, very straightforward with fun graphics, starting with the history of astronomy and what you see in the sky up to the end of the universe itself. So if you just look up Crash Course Astronomy, that will get you started. There are links there to more information, to NASA and other websites where you can learn more about this. And it hopefully will give you enough information that you can make these discoveries yourself and get the information you want if you have a question.
Cool. I will put that in the show notes.
Thank you.
Well, Dr. Plate, it's been a pleasure having you on the show. It's been a fascinating discussion.
The pleasure's all mine, John. Thanks
cool.
for having me on.
You're very welcome. It was great. So tell the listeners how to contact you if they wish.
If you want to find me, I've been on the web since there wasn't even a web. You can find me on Twitter. I'm Bad Astronomer, all one word. You can email me if you want. I'm thebadastronomer@gmail.com. And I've got a blog I write every day on Sci-Fi Wire. If you go to blaster.com, BLASTR.com, you'll find me writing about all sorts of issues about science, space, astronomy, and everything I can think of right there.
Excellent. Excellent. It's been cool. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Folks, I hope you enjoyed the show with Dr. Plate. And we'll see you again next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode. Thanks for coming by.